A rough idea of the distances. But how much ground had he covered? Glass could only guess. The temperature dropped precipitously with the arrival of the storm, but it was the wind that worried Glass. The wind seemed to animate the cold, endowing it with an ability to penetrate every seam of his clothing. He felt it first as a biting sting on the exposed flesh of his nose and ears. Wind forced water from the corners of his eyes, and his running nose created moisture, compounding the chill. As he trudged through the deepening snow, the sharp bite faded slowly into an aching numbness, leaving once agile fingers as lumps of dysfunctional flesh. He needed to seek shelter while he could still find fuel, and while his fingers could still work the flint and steel. The opposite bank rose steeply from the river. It would have provided some cover, but there was no way to ford the river. The terrain along his side of the river was featureless and flat, making no concessions to the driving wind. He saw a stand of a dozen cottonwoods about a mile away, barely perceptible through the blowing snow and the growing darkness. Why did I wait? It took 20 minutes to cover the distance. In places, the whipping wind had cleared the ground down to the dirt, but in others, the drifts rose to his knees. Snow filled his moccasins, and he cursed himself for not having fashioned gaiters. His deerskin breeches became wet from the snow and then froze solid, stiff shells encasing his lower legs. By the time he reached the cottonwoods, he could no longer feel his toes. The storm intensified as he scanned the tree stand for the best shelter. The wind seemed to blow from every direction at once, making it difficult to pick a spot. He settled on a downed cottonwood. The upturned roots spread out in a perpendicular arc from the thick base of the trunk, creating a windbreak in two directions. If only the wind would stop blowing from all four. He set down his rifle and immediately began to gather fuel. He found plenty of wood. The problem was tinder. Several inches of snow covered the ground. When he dug beneath it, the leaves were damp and unsuitable. He tried to snap small branches from the cottonwood, but it was still green. Glass scoured the clearing. Daylight seemed to pour away, and he realized with growing concern that it was later than he had thought. By the time he gathered what he needed, he was working in near total darkness. Glass piled his fuel next to the downed tree, then dug furiously to create a sheltered depression for the fire. He removed his mittens to handle the tinder, but his frozen fingers barely functioned. He cupped his hands against his mouth and blew into them. His breath created a brief tingle of warmth, which faded instantly against the onslaught of frigid air. He felt a new blast of bitter wind on his back and neck, penetrating to his skin, and then it seemed deeper still. Is the wind shifting? He paused for an instant, wondering whether he should move to the other side of the cottonwood. The wind receded, and he decided to stay put. He spread his tinder in the shallow depression, then dug into his sac à feu for the flint and steel. On his first attempt to strike the steel, his flint nicked the knuckle on his thumb. The sting extended all the way up his arm, like the vibration of a tuning fork. He tried to ignore the pain as he struck again at the steel. Finally, a spark landed in the tinder and began to burn. He dropped over the tiny flame, sheltering it with his body while blowing, desperate to breathe his own life into the fire. Suddenly, he felt a great swirling rush of wind and his face filled with sand and smoke from the depression. He coughed and rubbed at his eyes, and when he could open them, the flame was gone. Damn it! He pounded the flint against the steel. Sparks showered down, but too much of the tinder had already burned. The backs of his hands ached from the exposure. His fingers, meanwhile, had lost all sensation. Use the powder. He arranged the remaining tinder as best he could, this time adding larger pieces of wood. From his horn, he poured gunpowder, cursing as it gushed into the depression. He situated his body again to block as much wind as possible, then struck at the steel with his flint. A flash arose from the depression, burning his hands and singeing his face. He barely noticed the pain, so desperate was he to nurture the flames that now jumped up and down with the swirling wind. He crouched over the fire, spreading his capote to create a greater windbreak. Most of the tinder already had disappeared, but he saw with relief that some of the larger chunks were burning. He added more fuel and in a few minutes was confident that the fire would continue to burn on its own. He had just settled back against the downed tree when another great blast of wind nearly extinguished his fire. Again, he threw himself over the flames, spreading his capote to block the wind while he blew against the glowing embers. Sheltered again, the flames sprang back to life. Glass stayed in that position, hunched over the fire with his arms spread wide to hold the capote for almost half an hour. Snow piled around him, several more inches in the short time he guarded the flames. He could feel the weight of the drifting snow where the capote dragged the ground. He felt something else, and his stomach sank at the realization. It shifted. The wind beat against his back, no longer swirling, but with constant, relentless pressure. The cottonwood provided no shelter. Worse still, it caught the wind and turned it back against him and into the fire. He fought against a growing sense of panic, a vicious circle of conflicting fears. The starting point was clear. Without a fire, he would freeze to death. At the same time, he could not continue to hold his current position, stooped over the flames, arms spread wide, the blizzard beating at his back. He was exhausted, and the storm could easily rage for hours or even days. He needed shelter, however crude. The wind's direction now seemed consistent enough to bet on the other side of the tree. It couldn't be worse, but Glass doubted he could move without losing the fire. Could he start another fire from scratch? In the dark, with no tinder? He saw no choice but to try. He set upon a plan. He would rush to the other side of the downed cottonwood, scoop a new depression for the fire, then seek to transfer the flames. No sense waiting. He grabbed his rifle and as much of his fuel as he could carry. The wind seemed to sense the presence of a new target, blasting him with renewed fury. He ducked his head and waded around the giant roots, cursing as he felt more snow pour into his moccasins. The opposite side did seem better sheltered from the wind, though the snow was piled just as deep. He dropped his rifle and wood and began to scoop. It took 5 minutes to scrape an area large enough for a fire. He rushed back to the other side, retracing his footprints in the snow. The clouds made it almost completely dark, and he hoped for the glow of his fire as he came around the base of the tree. No light. No fire. The only sign of his fire was a faint depression in a mound of drifted snow. Glass dug down, foolishly hoping that somehow an ember might have survived. He found nothing, though the heat from the fire had turned the snow into a slushy mix. It soaked his woolen mittens. He felt the frigid chill of moisture on his hands, then an odd mixture of pains that seemed to burn and freeze all at the same time. He retreated quickly to the more sheltered side of the tree. The wind seemed to have settled on a course, but also intensified. His face ached, and his hands again lost all dexterity. He ignored his feet, which was easy since he felt no sensation below his ankles. With the more consistent direction of the wind, the cottonwood at least created a windbreak. The temperature continued to drop, though, and without a fire, Glass again thought he would die. There was no time to hunt for tinder, even if there had been enough light to see. He decided to cut kindling with his hatchet, then hope that another shot of gunpowder would be enough to start the blaze. For an instant, he worried about conserving his powder. Least of my problems. He drove the hatchet into the end of a short log to seat the blade, then pounded up and down to split the wood. The sound of his own work almost obscured another sound, a dull clap like distant thunder. He froze, his neck craning in search of the source. A rifle shot? No. Too big. Glass had heard thunder before during snowstorms, but never in temperatures this cold. He waited several minutes, listening intently. No sound competed with the screaming winds, and Glass became aware again of the excruciating pain in his hands. To wander in the storm on some quest for a strange sound seemed like folly. Start the damn fire. He planted the hatchet's blade in the top of another log. When he had cut a sufficient amount, Glass arranged the kindling in a pile and reached for his powder horn. It scared him how little powder remained. As he poured, he wondered if he should conserve some powder for a second attempt. He fumbled barely able to calibrate the actions of his frozen hands. No. This is it. He emptied the powder horn, then reached again for his flint and steel. He raised his flint to strike the steel, but before he could do so, an enormous roar rolled down the valley of the Yellowstone. This time, he knew. The unmistakable blast of a cannon. Henry. Glass stood, reaching for his rifle. The winds again found a target and pounded with a vigor that nearly staggered him. He began to wade through the deep snow toward the Yellowstone. Hope I'm on the right side of the river. Captain Henry was outraged at the loss of the cannon. Though the weapon had little utility in actual combat, its deterrent value was significant. Besides, a real fort had a cannon, and Henry wanted one for his. With the notable exception of the captain, the loss of the cannon had not dampened spirits at the fort's New Year's celebration. To the contrary, the great explosion seemed to boost the level of revelry. The blizzard drove the men back inside, but the cramped bunkhouse pulsed with a relentless cacophony of unbridled chaos. Then the cabin door blasted suddenly open, completely open, as if some great external force had built up outside before blowing the portal inward. The elements came in with the open door, frigid fingers grabbing at the men inside, ripping them from the snug comfort of the shelter and fire. "Close the door, you bloody idiot!" yelled Stubby Bill without looking at the door. Then they all did look. The wind shrieked outside. Snow swirled around the looming presence in the doorway, making it appear to be part of the storm, disgorged in their midst like some rogue element of the wilderness itself. Jim Bridger stared in horror at the specter. Driven snow was plastered against every surface of its body, encasing it in frozen white. On its face, ice clung to a haggard beard, and hung down like crystal daggers from the folded brow of a woolen cap. The apparition might have been carved wholly of winter, had not the crimson streaks of raking scars dominated its face, had not its eyes burned as fiery as molten lead. Bridger watched as the eyes scanned the interior of the cabin, deliberate and searching. Stunned silence filled the room, as the men struggled to comprehend the vision before them. Unlike the others, Bridger understood instantly. In his mind, he had seen this vision before. His guilt swelled up, churning like a paddle wheel in his stomach. He wanted desperately to flee. How do you escape something that comes from inside? The revenant, he knew, searched for him. Several instants passed before Black Harris finally said, "Jesus Christ, it's Hugh Glass." Glass scanned the stunned faces before him. Disappointment flashed briefly as he failed to locate Fitzgerald among the men. But he did find Bridger. Their eyes would have met, except Bridger turned away, just like before. He noticed the familiar knife that Bridger now wore at his waist. Glass lifted his rifle and cocked it. The desire to shoot Bridger down nearly overwhelmed him. Having crawled toward this moment for 100 days, the prospect of vengeance was now immediate, the power to consummate requiring no more than the gentle squeeze of a trigger. Yet a mere bullet seemed too intangible to express his rage and abstraction at a moment craving the satisfaction of flesh against flesh. Like a starving man set before a feast, he could pause briefly to enjoy the last moment of an aching hunger about to be sated. Glass lowered the rifle and leaned it against the wall. He walked slowly toward Bridger, the other men clearing a path as he approached.
"Where's my knife, Bridger?"
Glass stood directly before him. Bridger turned his head to look up at Glass. He felt the familiar disconnect between his desire to explain and his inability to do so.
"Stand up," said Glass.
Bridger stood. Glass's first punch struck him full force in the face. Bridger offered no resistance. He saw the punch coming, but did not turn his head or even wince. Glass could feel the cartilage snap in Bridger's nose, saw the torrent of blood set loose. He had imagined the satisfaction of this moment 1,000 times, and now it had arrived. He was glad he hadn't shot him, glad that he hadn't robbed himself of the full carnal pleasure of revenge. Glass's second blow caught Bridger under the chin, knocking him backward against the log wall of the cabin. Again, Glass wallowed in the raw satisfaction of the contact. The wall kept Bridger from falling, holding him upright. Glass closed in tight now, erupting in a spasm of punches against Bridger's face. When the blood became so thick that his punches began to slide off ineffectively, he shifted his blows to Bridger's stomach. Bridger crumpled as he lost his wind, finally falling to the floor. Glass began to kick him, and Bridger could not or would not fight back. Bridger, too, had seen the approach of this day. It was his reckoning, and he felt no entitlement to resist. Finally, Pig stepped forward. Even through the haze of alcohol, Pig had pieced together the full implications of the violent event unfolding before him. Clearly, Bridger and Fitzgerald had lied about their time with Glass. Still, it seemed wrong to let Glass walk in and kill their friend and comrade. Pig reached to grab Glass from behind. But someone grabbed him. Pig turned to find Captain Henry. Pig appealed to the captain.
You gonna let him kill Bridger?
I'm not gonna do anything, said the captain. Pig started to protest further, but Henry cut him off. This is for Glass to decide. Glass delivered another brutal kick. Though he tried to contain it, Bridger groaned at the impact of the blow. Glass stood above the crumpled form at his feet, panting at the sheer exertion of the beating he had inflicted. He felt his heart pound in his temple as his eyes came to rest again on the knife in Bridger's belt. In his mind, he saw Bridger standing at the edge of the clearing on that day, catching the knife that Fitzgerald had thrown. My knife! He reached down and pulled the long blade from its sheath. The grip of the molded pommel felt like the embrace of a familiar hand. He thought of the times he had needed that knife, and his hate spiked again. The moments arrived. How long had he nourished himself with the prospect of this moment? And now it had arrived. A vengeance more perfect than even his imagination had conjured. He turned the blade in his hand, felt its weight, prepared to drive it home. He looked down at Bridger. And something unexpected began to happen. The perfection of the moment began to evaporate. Bridger looked back at Glass, and in his eyes, Glass saw not malice, but fear. Not resistance, but resignation. Fight back, damn you! One twitch of opposition to justify the final strike. It never came. Glass continued to grip the knife, staring at the boy. A boy. As Glass looked down at him, new images suddenly competed with his memory of the stolen knife. He remembered the boy tending his wounds, arguing with Fitzgerald. He saw other images, too, like the ashen face of Lavierge on the cut bank of the Missouri. Glass's breathing began to slow. His temple ceased to pulsate in sync with his heart. He looked around the room, as if suddenly aware of the ring of men surrounding him. He stared for a long time at the knife in his hand, then slipped it in his belt. Turning from the boy, Glass realized he was cold, and walked toward the fire, extending his bloodied hands to the warmth of the crackling flames. 22. February 27th, 1824. A steamship named Dolly Madison had arrived in St. Louis the week before. It carried a cargo of goods from Cuba, including sugar, rum, and cigars. William H. Ashley loved cigars, and he wondered briefly why the fat Cuban perched on his lip was failing to impart its usual pleasure. Of course, he knew the reason. When he walked each day to the riverfront, he didn't go in search of steamships bearing trifles from the Caribbean. No, he went in ravenous anticipation of a fur-laden pirogue from the far west. Where are they? There had been no word from Andrew Henry or Jedediah Smith in 5 months. 5 months! Ashley paced the length of his cavernous office at the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. He hadn't been able to sit still all day. He stopped again in front of the enormous map on the wall. The map was ornate, at least it had been. Ashley had punctured it with more pins than a tailor's dummy, and used a fat pencil to scratch the location of rivers, streams, trading posts, and other assorted landmarks. His eyes traced the path up the Missouri, and he tried again to fight off the sensation of impending ruin. He paused, staring at a spot on the river just west of St. Louis, where one of his flatboats had sunk with $10,000 worth of supplies. He paused at the pin marking the Arikara villages, where 16 of his men had been murdered and robbed, and where even the power of the U.S. Army had been unable to clear a path for his venture. He paused at a bend in the Missouri above the Mandan villages, where 2 years before, Henry had lost a herd of 70 horses to the Assiniboine. He followed the Missouri past Fort Union to the Great Falls, where an attack by the Blackfeet had later sent Henry retreating down the river. He looked down at a letter in his hand, the latest inquiry from one of his investors. The letter demanded an update on the status of the venture on the Missouri. I have no idea. And of course, every penny of Ashley's own fortune rode with Andrew Henry and Jedediah Smith. Ashley felt an overwhelming desire to act, to strike out, to do something, to do anything, yet there was nothing more he could do. He already had managed to secure a loan for a new keelboat and provisions. The keelboat floated at a dock on the river, and his provisions sat stacked in a warehouse. His recruitment for a new fur brigade was oversubscribed. He'd spent weeks culling 40 men from 100 who applied. In April, he would personally lead his men up the Missouri. More than a month away. And where would he go? When Ashley dispatched Henry and Smith last August, their loose understanding was to rendezvous in the field, location to be determined through messengers. Messengers. His eyes returned to the map. He used his finger to trace the scrawled line that represented the Grand River. He remembered drawing that line and how he had guessed at the course of the river. Was I right? Did the Grand provide a direct line toward Fort Union? Or did it veer in some other direction? How long had it taken Henry and his men to reach the fort? Long enough, it appeared, that they had not been able to conduct a fall hunt. Are they even alive? Captain Andrew Henry, Hugh Glass, and Black Harris sat next to the dying coals of the fire in the bunkhouse of the fort on the Bighorn. Henry stood and walked outside the cabin, returning with an armful of wood. He set a log on the coals, and the three men watched as flames reached eagerly for the fresh fuel.
I need a messenger to go back to St. Louis, said Henry. I should have sent one before, but I wanted to wait till we were set up on the Bighorn.
Glass seized immediately at the opportunity.
I'll go, Captain.
Fitzgerald and the Anstaat were somewhere down the Missouri. Besides, a month in Henry's company had been more than sufficient to remind Glass of the cloudy weather that the captain could not shake.
Good. I'll give you 3 men and horses. I assume you agree that we ought to stay off the Missouri?
Glass nodded.
I think we ought to try the Powder down to the Platte. Then it's a straight shot to Fort Atkinson.
Why not the Grand?
More chances of Rees on the Grand. Besides, if we're lucky, we might bump into Jed Smith on the Powder.
The next day, Pig heard from a trapper named Red Archibald that Hugh Glass was returning to St. Louis, carrying a message to William H. Ashley from the captain. He immediately sought out Captain Henry and volunteered to go along. As much as he feared a journey away from the relative comfort of the fort, the prospect of staying was worse. Pig was not cut out for life as a trapper, and he knew it. He thought about his former life as a cooper's apprentice. He missed his old life and its rudimentary comforts more than he imagined possible. Red was going too, and a friend of his, a bow-legged Englishman named William Chapman. Red and Chapman had been plotting to desert when the rumor spread about messengers to St. Louis. Captain Henry was even paying a bounty to the volunteers. A company in Glass would save them the trouble of sneaking off. They could leave early and get paid for this privilege. Chapman and Red could scarcely believe their good fortune.
"You remember the saloon at Fort Atkinson?" asked Red.
Chapman laughed. He remembered it well, the last taste of decent whiskey on their way up the Missouri. John Fitzgerald heard none of the bawdy din in the saloon at Fort Atkinson. He was too focused on his cards, picking them up one by one as they were dealt from the stained felt top of the table.
Ace. Maybe my luck is changing.
5, 7, 4. Then, ace.
Yes.
He looked around the table. The smarmy lieutenant with a big pile of coins threw 3 cards on the table and said,
"I'll take 3 and bet $5.
The sutler threw down all of his cards.
"I'm out."
A strapping boatman threw down a single card and pushed $5 to the center of the table. Fitzgerald threw down 3 cards as he calculated his competition. The boatman was an idiot, presumably drawing for a straight or a flush. The lieutenant was probably holding a pair, but not a pair that could beat his aces.
"I see your 5, and I'll raise you 5.
"See me 5 and raise me 5 with what?"
asked the lieutenant. Fitzgerald felt the blood rise in his face, felt the familiar pounding at his temple. He was down $100, every penny from the pelts he had sold that afternoon to the sutler. He turned to the sutler.
"Okay, old man, I'll sell you the second half of that pack of beaver, same price, $5 a plu."
A poor cards player, the sutler was a cagey trader.
"Price has gone down since this afternoon. I'll give you $3 a plu." "You son of a bitch," hissed Fitzgerald.
"Call me whatever you like," replied the sutler, "but that's my price."
Fitzgerald took another look at the pompous lieutenant, then nodded to the sutler. The sutler counted $60 from a leather purse, stacking the coins in front of Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald pushed $10 to the center of the table. The dealer threw a card to the boatman, and 3 each to Fitzgerald and the lieutenant. Fitzgerald picked them up.
7. Jack. 3. God damn it.
He struggled to keep his face impassive. He looked up to see the lieutenant staring at him, the slightest hint of a smile at the corner of his mouth.
"You bastard."
Fitzgerald pushed the rest of his money to the center of the table.
"Raise you $50.
The boatman whistled and threw his cards on the table. The lieutenant's eyes traveled across the mound of money in the center of the table and came to rest on Fitzgerald.
"That's a lot of money, Mr. What was it, Fitzpatrick?"
Fitzgerald fought to control himself.
"Fitzgerald."
"Fitzgerald, yes, sorry."
Fitzgerald gauged the lieutenant.
"He'll fold. He hasn't got the nerve."
The lieutenant held his cards in one hand and drummed his fingers with the other. He pursed his lips, making his long mustache droop even further. It irritated Fitzgerald, especially the way that he stared.
"I'll see you 50 and call," said the lieutenant.
Fitzgerald felt his stomach sink. His jaw tensed as he turned over the pair of aces.
"Pair of aces," said the lieutenant. "Well, that would have beat my pair.
He threw down a pair of threes. Except, I got another one. He tossed another three on the table.
I believe you're done for the evening, Mr. Fitz-whatever, unless the good sutler will buy your little canoe.
The lieutenant reached for the mound of money in the center of the table. Fitzgerald pulled the skinning knife from his belt and slammed it into the back of the lieutenant's hand. The lieutenant screamed as the knife pinned his hand to the table. Fitzgerald grabbed a whiskey bottle and shattered it on the pitiful lieutenant's head. He was poised to ram the jagged neck of the bottle into the lieutenant's throat when two soldiers grabbed him from behind, wrestling him to the ground. Fitzgerald spent the night in the guardhouse. In the morning, he found himself in shackles, standing before a major in a mess hall dressed up to look like a court of law. The major talked for a long time in a stilted verse and cadence that made little sense to Fitzgerald. The lieutenant was there, his hand in a bloody bandage. The major interrogated the lieutenant for half an hour, then did the same thing with the sutler, the boatman, and three other witnesses from the bar. Fitzgerald found the whole proceeding curious, since he had no intention of denying that he'd stabbed the lieutenant. After an hour, the major told Fitzgerald to approach the bench, which Fitzgerald assumed was the rather ordinary desk behind which the major had ensconced himself. The major said, "This martial court finds you guilty of assault. You may choose between two sentences, 5 years imprisonment or 3 years enlistment in the United States Army." One quarter of Fort Atkinson's men had deserted that year. The major took full advantage of opportunities to replenish his troops. For Fitzgerald, the decision was simple. He'd seen the guardhouse. No doubt he could break out eventually, but enlistment presented a far easier path. Later that day, John Fitzgerald raised his right hand and swore an oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the United States of America as a new private in the 6th Regiment of the U.S. Army. Until such time as he could desert, Fort Atkinson would be his home. Hugh Glass was tying a pack on a horse when he saw Jim Bridger walking toward him across the yard. Before now, the boy had avoided him scrupulously. This time, both his walk and his gaze were unwavering. Glass stopped his work and watched the boy approach. When Bridger reached Glass, he stopped. "I want you to know that I'm sorry for what I did." He paused for a moment before adding, "I wanted you to know that before you left." Glass started to respond, then stopped. He had wondered if the boy would approach him. He had even thought about what he would say, rehearsed in his mind a lengthy lecture. Yet as he looked now at the boy, the particulars of his prepared speech eluded him. He felt something unexpected, a strange mixture of pity and respect. Finally, Glass said simply,
"Follow your own lead, Bridger."
Then he turned back to the horse. An hour later, Hugh Glass and his three companions rode out of the fort on the Bighorn, bound for the Powder and the Platte. 23. March 6th, 1824. Only the tops of the highest buttes held a grip on the few rays of sunlight. As Glass watched, even those were extinguished. It was an interlude that he held as sacred as Sabbath, the brief segue between the light of day and the dark of night. The retreating sun drew with it the harshness of the plain. Howling winds ebbed, replaced by an utter stillness that seemed impossible for a vista so grand. The colors, too, were transformed. Stark daytime hues blended and blurred, softened by a gentle wash of ever-darkening purples and blues. It was a moment for reflection in a space so vast it could only be divine. And if Glass believed in a god, surely it resided in this great western expanse, not a physical presence, but an idea, something beyond man's ability to comprehend, something larger. The darkness deepened, and Glass watched as the stars emerged, dim at first, later bright as lighthouse beacons. It had been a long time since he studied the stars, though the lessons of the old Dutch sea captain remained fixed in his mind.
Know the stars and you'll always have a compass.
Glass picked out Ursa Major, following its guide to the North Star. He searched for Orion, dominant on the eastern horizon. Orion, the hunter, his vengeful sword poised to strike. Red interrupted the silence.
You get the lay watch, Pig.
Red kept a careful tally of the distribution of chores. Pig needed no reminder. He pulled his blanket tightly over his head and closed his eyes. They camped in a dry ravine that night, a ravine that cut the plain like a giant wound. Water had formed it, but not the gentle, nourishing rains of other places. Water came to the high plain in the torrential flood of spring runoff, or as the violent spawn of a summer storm. Unaccustomed to moisture, the ground could not absorb it. The water's effect was not to nourish, but to destroy. Pig was certain that he had just fallen asleep when he felt the persistent prodding of Red's foot.
You're up, said Red.
Pig grunted, hoisting his body to a sitting position before working his way to his feet. The splash of the Milky Way was like a white river across the midnight sky. Pig looked up briefly, his only thought that the clear sky made it colder. He wrapped his blanket around his shoulders, picked up his rifle, and walked down the ravine. Two Shoshone watched the changing of the guard from behind a clump of sagebrush. They were boys, Little Bear and Rabbit, 12-year-olds, on a quest not for glory, but for meat. But it was glory that now stood before them in the form of 5 horses. The boys imagined themselves galloping into their village. They imagined the bonfires and feast that would celebrate them. They imagined the stories they would tell of their cunning and bravery. They could scarcely believe their good fortune as they stared into the ravine, though the nearness of the opportunity filled them with fear as much as excitement. They waited until the last hour before dawn, hoping the guards' attentiveness would fade as the night wore on. It did. They could hear the man snoring as they crept from the sage. They let the horses see them and smell them as they crept up the ravine. The animals stood tense but quiet, ears perked as they watched the deliberate approach. When the boys finally reached the horses, Little Bear slowly extended his arms, stroking the long neck of the nearest animal and whispering soothingly. Rabbit followed Little Bear's lead. They patted the horses for several minutes, gaining the animal's confidence, before Little Bear pulled his knife and went to work on the hobbles that bound each animal's front legs together. The boys had cut the hobbles from 4 of the 5 horses when they heard the sentries stir. They froze, each prepared to jump on a horse and gallop off. They stared at the dark hulk of the guard, and he seemed to settle again. Rabbit motioned urgently to Little Bear. Let's go! Little Bear shook his head resolutely, pointing to the 5th horse. He walked to the animal and stooped to cut the hobble. His knife had grown dull, and it took an agonizing length of time to saw slowly through the twisted rawhide. In growing frustration and nervousness, Little Bear gave a hard tug at the knife. The rawhide snapped, and his arm jerked backward. His elbow bashed into the horse's shin, eliciting a loud whinny from the animal in protest. The sound jolted Pig from his sleep. He struggled to his feet, eyes wide and rifle cocked as he rushed toward the horses. Pig pulled up suddenly as a dark form appeared directly in front of him. He skidded to a halt, surprised to be confronted by a boy. The boy, Rabbit, looked about as menacing as his namesake, all wide eyes and spindly limbs. One of those limbs held a knife, though. Another, a length of rope. Pig struggled to know what to do. His job was to defend the horses. But even with the knife, the mere boy before him seemed a good measure short of threatening. Finally, Pig simply pointed his rifle and yelled, "Stop!" Little Bear stared in horror at the scene before him. He had never seen a white man before that evening, and this one did not even appear to be human. He was enormous, with a chest like a bear and a face covered in fiery hair. The giant approached Rabbit, yelling wildly and pointing his gun.
Without thinking, Little Bear rushed at the monster, burying his knife in its chest. Pig saw a blur from his side before he felt the knife. He stood there, stunned. Little Bear and Rabbit stood there too, still terrified at the creature before them. Pig's legs felt suddenly weak, and he dropped to his knees. Instinct told him to squeeze the trigger of his gun. It exploded, the bullet launching harmlessly toward the stars. Rabbit managed to grab a horse by the mane, pulling himself to the animal's back. He yelled at Little Bear, who took one last look at the dying monster before leaping behind his friend. They had no control of the horse, which almost bucked them before all five animals galloped down the ravine. Glass and the others arrived just in time to watch their horses disappear into the night. Pig still stood on his knees, his hands clutched to his chest. He fell to his side. Glass bent over Pig, prying his hands away from the wound. He pulled back Pig's shirt. The three men stared grimly at the dark slit directly over his heart. Pig looked up at Glass. His eyes, a terrible mixture of pleading and fear.
Fix me up, Glass.
Glass picked up Pig's massive hand and held it tightly.
I don't think I can, Pig.
Pig coughed. His big body gave a mighty shudder, like the ponderous moment before a great tree falls. Glass felt the hand go limp. The giant man gave one final sigh and died there beneath the bright stars of the plain. 24. March 7th, 1824. Hugh Glass stabbed at the ground with his knife. It penetrated an inch at most. Below that, the frozen earth remained unpersuaded by the blade. Glass chipped away for almost an hour before Red observed,
"You can't dig a grave in ground like that."
Glass sat back, his legs folded beneath him, panting from the exertion of the dig.
"I'd make more progress if you pitched in."
"I'll pitch in, but I don't see much use in chipping away at ice."
Chapman looked up from an antelope rib long enough to add, "Pig's gonna take a big hole."
"We could build him one of those scaffolds like they bury the Indians on," offered Red.
Chapman snorted. "What's he gonna build it with, sagebrush?" Red looked around him, as if newly aware of the treeless plain. "Besides," continued Chapman, "Pig's too big for us to lift up on a scaffold."
"What if we just covered him with a big mound of rocks?"
This idea had merit, and they spent half an hour scouring the area for stones. In the end, though, they managed to locate only a dozen or so. Most of those had to be extricated from the same frozen soil that prevented the digging of the grave.
"These are hardly enough to cover his head," said Chapman.
"Well," said Red, "if we covered up his head, at least the magpies wouldn't pick at his face."
Red and Chapman were surprised when Glass turned suddenly and walked away from the camp.
"Now where's he gone?" asked Red.
"Hey!"
he shouted at Glass's back.
"Where are you going?"
Glass ignored them as he walked toward a small mesa a quarter mile away.
"Hope those Shoshone don't come back while he's gone."
Chapman nodded his head in agreement. "Let's get a fire going and cook some more of the antelope." Glass returned about an hour later.
"There's an outcropping in the base of that mesa," he said. "It's big enough to hold Pig."
"In a cave?"
said Red. Chapman thought about it for a minute.
"Well, I guess it's kind of like a crypt."
Glass looked at the two men and said,
"It's the best we can do. Put out the fire and let's get on with it."
There was no dignified way to move Pig. There were no materials to build a litter, and he was too heavy to carry. In the end, they put him face down on a blanket and dragged him toward the mesa. Two men took turns with Pig, while the third carried the four rifles. They did their best, with mixed results, to steer around the cactus and yucca that littered the ground. Twice, Pig dropped to the ground, his rigid body landing in a plaintive, ungainly lump. It took more than half an hour to reach the mesa. They rolled Pig on his back and covered him with a blanket while they gathered stones, now abundant, to seal the makeshift crypt. Sandstone formed the outcropping. It hung over a space about 5 feet in length and 2 feet in height. Glass used the butt of Pig's rifle to clear out the space inside. Some type of animal had nested in there, though there was no sign of recent occupation. They piled up a great mound of loose sandstone, more than they needed, hesitant, it seemed, to move on to the final stage. Finally, Glass threw a stone on the pile and said, "That's enough." He walked over to Pig's body, and the other men helped him pull the dead man to the opening of the makeshift crypt. They lay him there, all of them staring. The task of saying something fell to Glass. He removed his hat, and the other men quickly followed suit, as if embarrassed at needing a prompt. Glass tried to clear his throat. He searched for the words to the verse about the Valley of Death, but he couldn't remember enough to make it appropriate. In the end, the best he could come up with was the Lord's Prayer. He recited it in the strongest voice he could muster. It had been a long time since either Red or Chapman had said a prayer, but they mumbled along whenever a phrase evoked some distant memory. When they were done, Glass said,
"We'll take turns carrying his rifle."
Next, he reached down and took the knife from Pig's belt.
"Red, you look like you could use his knife. Chapman, you can have his powder horn."
Chapman accepted the horn solemnly. Red turned the knife in his hand. With a short smile and a brief flash of eagerness, he said,
"That's a pretty good blade."
Glass reached down and removed the small pouch that Pig wore around his throat. He dumped the contents onto the ground. A flint and steel tumbled out, along with several musket balls, patches, and a delicate pewter bracelet. It struck Glass as an odd possession for the giant man.
What story connected the dainty trinket to Pig? A dead mother? A sweetheart left behind?
They would never know. And the finality of the mystery filled Glass with melancholy thoughts of his own souvenirs. Glass picked out the flint and steel, the balls and patches, transferring the items to his own possibles bag. Sunlight gleamed off the bracelet. Red reached for it, but Glass caught his wrist. Red's eyes flashed defensively.
"You don't need that."
"You don't need it either."
Glass returned the bracelet to Pig's pouch, then lifted Pig's massive head to replace the pouch round his neck. It took another hour to finish their work. They had to bend Pig's legs to make him fit. There was barely enough space between Pig and the walls of the outcropping to pull the blanket over his body. Glass did his best to tuck the fabric tightly over the dead man's face. They piled the rocks to seal the crypt as best they could. Glass placed the last stone, gathered his rifle, and walked away. Red and Chapman stared for a moment at the stone wall they had built, then scampered after Glass. They walked down the Powder River along the face of the mountains for 2 more days until the river took a sharp turn west. They found a creek heading south and followed that until it petered out, swallowed in the alkali flats of the most wretched land they had crossed. They kept heading south toward a low mountain shaped flat on top like a table. In front of the mountain ran the wide, shallow water of the North Platte River. The day after they reached the Platte, a big wind picked up, and the temperature began a rapid plunge. By late morning, close clouds filled the air with big, puffy flakes. Glass's memory of the blizzard on the Yellowstone remained vivid, and this time he vowed to take no chances. They stopped at the next stand of cottonwoods. Red and Chapman built a crude but solid lean-to while Glass shot and dressed a deer.
By late afternoon, a full-fledged blizzard raged down the North Platte Valley. The great cottonwoods creaked at the strain of the howling wind, and wet snow piled up rapidly all around them. But their shelter held firm. They wrapped themselves in blankets and kept an enormous fire burning in front of the lean-to. Heat seeped from the great mound of crimson embers that accumulated as the night wore on. They roasted venison on the fire, and the hot food warmed them from within. The wind began to subside about an hour before dawn, and by sunrise the storm had blown past. The sun rose on a world so uniformly white that it forced them to squint against its brilliant reflection. Glass scouted downstream while Red and Chapman broke camp. Glass struggled to walk through the snow. A thin crust on the surface supported each step for an instant, but then his foot would break through and sink to the ground below. Some of the drifts measured more than 3 feet high. He guessed that the March sun would melt it all within a day or two, but in the meantime, the snow would cripple their progress on foot. Glass cursed again the loss of their horses. He wondered whether they should wait, use the time to lay in a supply of jerky. A good supply of meat would relieve the need for daily foraging, and of course, the faster they moved, the better. A number of tribes considered the Platte their hunting ground: the Shoshone, the Cheyenne, the Pawnee, the Arapaho, the Sioux. Some of these Indians might be friendly, though Pig's death certainly underscored the hazards. Glass crested a butte and stopped dead in his tracks. 100 yards in front of him, a small herd of 50 or so buffalo huddled together, holding a protective circular formation from their own recent battle with the storm. The lead bull spotted him immediately. The animal pivoted into the herd, and the great mass of animals began to move.
"They're gonna stampede."
Glass dropped to his knee and brought his rifle to his shoulder. He aimed at a fat cow and fired. He saw the cow stagger at the shot, but she held her feet. Not enough powder at this range. He doubled the charge, reloading in 10 seconds. He sighted again on the cow and pulled the trigger. The cow pitched into the snow. He scanned the horizon as he jammed the ramrod down the barrel. When he looked back at the herd, Glass was surprised that they hadn't stampeded out of range. And yet every animal seemed in flailing motion. He watched a bull struggling at the front of the herd. The bull lunged forward, sinking to his chest in the deep, wet snow.
"They can barely move."
Glass wondered if he should shoot another cow or calf, but quickly decided that they had more than enough meat.
"Too bad," he thought. "I could shoot a dozen if I wanted."
Then an idea struck him, and he wondered why he hadn't thought of it before. He moved to within 40 yards of the herd, aimed at the biggest bull he could find, and fired. He reloaded and quickly shot another bull. Suddenly, 2 shots rang out behind him. A calf fell into the snow, and he turned to see Chapman and Red.
"Yee-haw!"
yelled Red.
"Just the bulls!"
yelled Glass.
Red and Chapman moved up beside him, eagerly reloading.
"Why?" asked Chapman. "The calves are better eating."
"It's the hides I'm after," said Glass.
"We're making a bull boat."
5 minutes later, 11 bulls lay dead in the little vale. It was more than they needed, but Red and Chapman were caught in a frenzy once the shooting started. Glass pushed his ramrod hard to reload. The flurry of shooting had fouled his barrel. Only when the charge was seated and the pan primed did he approach the closest bull.
"Chapman, get on up that ridgeline and take a look around. That's a lot of noise we just made. Red, start putting that new knife to use."
Glass approached the closest bull. In his glazed eyes shone the last dim spark of vitality as its lifeblood pooled around him on the snow. Glass walked from the bull to the cow. He pulled out his knife and cut her throat. This is the one they would eat, and he wanted to be sure she was properly bled.
"Come over here, Red. It's easier if we skin them together."
They rolled the cow on her side, and Glass made a deep cut the length of the belly. Red used his hands to pull the hide back while Glass cut it away from the carcass. They laid the hide fur side down while they carved out the best cuts: the tongue, the liver, the hump, and the loins. They threw the meat on the hide and then went to work on the bulls. Chapman returned
and Glass set him to work, too.
We need to cut as big a square as we can out of each hide, so don't be hacking away.
His arms already red to the shoulder, Red looked up from the great carcass beneath him. Shooting the buffalo had been exhilarating. Skinning them was just a big damn mess.
Why don't we just make a raft? He complained. There's plenty of timber along the river.
Blatt's too shallow, especially this time of year.
Aside from the abundance of building materials, the great benefit of the bowl boat was its draft, barely 9 inches. The mountain runoff that would flood the banks was still months away. In early spring, the Platte hardly trickled. Around noon, Glass sent Red back to camp to set fires for jerking meat. Behind him, Red dragged the cow's hide across the snow, piled high with choice cuts. They took the tongues from the bulls, but otherwise worried only about the hides.
Roast up that liver and a couple of those tongues for tonight,
yelled Chapman. Skinning the bulls was the first of many steps. With each hide, Glass and Chapman worked to cut the largest square possible. They needed uniform edges. Their knives dulled quickly against the thick winter fur, forcing them to stop frequently and sharpen their blades. When they finished, it took 3 trips to drag the hides back to camp. A new moon danced merrily on the North Platte by the time they laid out the last skin in a clearing near the camp. To his credit, Red had worked diligently. 3 low fires burned in rectangular pits. All the meat had been cut into thin slices and hung over willow racks. Red had been gorging himself all afternoon, and the smell of the roasting meat was overwhelming. Glass and Chapman stuffed mouthful after mouthful of the succulent meat. They ate for hours, contented not only by the abundant food, but also by the absence of wind and cold. It seemed incredible that they had huddled in a blizzard the night before.
You ever make a bull boat?
Asked Red at one point. Glass nodded.
Pawnee use 'em on the Arkansas. Takes a while, but there's not much to it. Frame of branches wrapped in skin, like a big bowl.
I don't see how they float.
The hides stretch tight as drums when they dry. You just caulk up the seams every morning.
It took a week to build the bull boats. Glass opted for 2 smaller boats rather than 1 larger one. All of them could fit into 1 in a pinch. The smaller craft were also lighter and could float easily in any water deeper than 1 foot. They spent the first day cutting sinews from the buffalo carcasses and building the frames. They used large cottonwood branches for the gunwales, bent in the shape of a ring. From the gunwales, they worked their way down with progressively narrower rings. Between the rings, they braided vertical supports with stout willow branches, tying the joints with sinew. Working the hides took the longest. They used 6 per boat. Stitching the skins together was tedious work. They used their knife tips to auger holes, then sewed the skins tightly together with the sinew. When they finished, they had 2 giant squares, each consisting of 4 hides laid out 2 by 2. In the center of each rectangle, they placed their wooden frames. They pulled the hides over the gunwale with the fur toward the inside of the boat. They trimmed the excess, then used sinew to stitch around the top. When they were finished, they set the boats upside down to dry. Caulk required another trip to the dead buffalo in the vale.
Jesus, it stinks, said Red.
Sunny weather since the blizzard had melted the snow and set the carcasses to rot. Magpies and crows swarmed over the plentiful meat, and Glass worried that the circling carrion eaters would signal their presence. Not much they could do about it, except finish the boats and leave. They cut tallow from the buffalo and used their hatchets to hack off slices from the hooves. Back at the camp, they combined the reeking mixture with water and ash, melting it together slowly over coals into a sticky, liquid mass. Their cooking pot was small, so it took 2 days to prepare the 12 batches necessary to render the quantity they required. They applied the caulk mixture to the seams, liberally smearing the mixture. Glass checked the boats as they dried in the March sun. A stiff, dry wind helped the process along. He was pleased with the work. They left the next morning. Glass in one boat with their supplies, Red and Chapman in the other. It took a few miles to get the feel for their clumsy craft, pushing with cottonwood poles along the banks of the Platte. But the boats were sturdy. A week had passed since the blizzard, a long time to sit in one place.